Now the army, Ryu, and yourself are all trying at once to find this Akira guy. What the hell is this Akira thing, huh?
Akira's ultimate energy.
The thing about Akira's power is, it exists within everyone from the start. But when that power is awakened inside, it is important to wisely choose how to use it.
Long ago, there were people who tried to gain control of that power. That is all at the government's request. But they failed in their attempt, and it triggered the fall of Tokyo.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Akira.
It's a trap.
Go back then.
No way! I want to find out how much of a trap it is, don't you?
Hosted by Arnie.
He's the one! He's the one who's been invading my head all along!
Stuart.
He may not be able to control the power that has awakened so suddenly.
And Jacob.
If we went in there, we wouldn't be strong enough to come back out again.
But if the three of us tried...
You're right. Us three together.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Your friend has already made his choice.
Listener discretion is advised.
All right, let's hit it!
Today we're discussing Akira.
No, that's not even close.
Say it right. I'm an American. Akira.
No, I watched the English dub. It's Akira.
You saw the new one.
It's sometimes it's Akira. They change how they say it.
Are we going to say Akira? I never heard that in the movie.
It's Kaneda and Akira to me forever.
It's not Canada. I know that.
Yeah, I'm not doing Canada. No way.
Starring Mitsuo Iwata, Nozomu Sasaki, Mamie Koyama, or starring Jimmy Finders, Stanley Gurd Jr., and Deanna Morris, or starring Johnny Yong Bosch, Joshua Seth, and Wendy Lee, but in all cases, directed by Katsuhiro Otomo. This is Arnie, but without my mic, I'm just a tail chaser out of water, whatever that means.
It feels true, though. Stuart.
And this is the host who's just a puppet of corrupt politicians and capitalists, Jacob.
I always feel like you give those quotes.
So why are we talking Akira?
Because my life is now complete. I can finally check off the box of the last essential. You know what? It wasn't the movie. I'm going to go ahead and clarify right now. I am a huge Akira fan. Sorry, that's the way I learned it. That's the way I'm going to say it. But it wasn't because of this movie alone. This is the first comic book I ever collected, and to this date, my favorite comic book. I don't know if you remember this, Arnie. I was in Metropolis Comics with you, perusing. I had window shopped. I had picked up an Iron Man. I was trying to find my way, what was going to be my comic book, and I picked up issue number 9 of this strange Japanese saga that was coming out on a Marvel imprint. I didn't know what it was. I just bought it on a whim and totally got caught up in it. And like, it was at a pivotal moment. It was not long after that they actually unleashed Akira and like the storyline that's not in this movie kicked off. And that was back in the day when you had to go and find back issues. Like, you had to go into different shops and dig through. You go to the A, you look around, do they have issue number 3? Nope.
And they always charge like $3 more for that back issue you need.
It took me forever to assemble it, but I had most of the comic book run and collected it for about 2 years and got obsessed on it. So much so that my brother heard that I was always bringing it up. It's a special memory between him and I. He actually drove me to Champaign. He was in college in a totally different town, but they were playing it in an art theater in Champaign. And we went on a cold winter in 1990, I believe, to see this movie in theaters. It was the first time I had ever seen an anime movie in theaters. And it was extra cool because it was my brother in a college town. And we kept saying we were going to see Akira, and people thought we were going to go see a movie by Akira Kurosawa. They're like, yes. Are you seeing Ron? Are you seeing Seventh Samurai, Rashomon, which one? I'm like, no, Akira.
I gotta ask, are you an anime guy? Because we gotta approach that topic with Akira. Are you into anime generally?
I always flirt with the idea. I always imagine myself as someone that's open to it, although I find that when I actually sit down and watch many of them, it can be fitful. There's usually sequences or things that I like, and then there's things that either culturally I don't get it, or maybe some of the misogyny or just some of it just is unappealing.
Yeah, I do feel like being an anime person, that is a whole thing. And I know, like, my wife has a bias. She thinks anime, she's thinking tentacle porn. Like, that's just the stereotype.
Sure.
And so she's like, ooh, that stuff is creepy. But I flirted. I experimented in college. and I knew some people that were anime people. I'm like, and I liked Cowboy Bebop. Like, Cartoon Network, they had their Toonami where they would play anime. And I really got into Cowboy Bebop, which is like bounty hunters in space mixed with Bruce Lee, and I was really into that. So I tried out some other series like Trigun, and I've seen, I think, the first Ghost in the Shell movie. Not the Scarlett Johansson, but the anime.
I usually see if it's big enough. Like, I keep it surface level. If it gets enough hype, I'll see it. And that's true even now. I mean, people were talking about Your Name. That was a recent title people were really up on. I went and I saw it. It was impressive. Totally not what I expected. But I will still seek out the big ones, but I won't go see everything. And there's a lot that I don't respond to.
I do have a weird history with this. Artie, when you're reading off the credits, Jimmy Finders, I believe you said?
Yes.
For the 91 dub, that is actually my relative that is a voice actor. He worked on the original Ninja Turtles cartoon series, and he was the voice of Kaneda in the 91 dub. It's weird. If you look at IMDb, like, all the American actors, that's not his real name. They all used fake names for some reason. I'm not sure. Maybe they're embarrassed to be doing an anime, but because he did that, you know, with every cartoon he worked on, he's got Denver the Last Dinosaur, if you remember that. He always has cells from these animation things he worked on, and I'd go to his house, and he'd always have an Akira cell, and, you know, I think Akira, I think motorcycles and that red jacket with a pill on it. And I totally thought this was just like a motorcycle anime movie because I'd always see that image. And it wasn't until I was in college that I finally got around to seeing this. When I was, again, experimenting with anime, I'm like, I gotta watch this one. This is like the big one. But I thought it was the dub with him. It's not. They changed the dub in 2001. They came out with a new dub and he's been replaced.
And you know, Arnie, I tried to get you excited. I think it was one of the few times I can remember where you were embarrassed to be around me. We had gone back to the comic book shop and I had run and picked up the new issue of Akira and was flipping out because it was the one where Tetsuo like flew up to the moon and blew a hole in it and started flooding Neo Tokyo. And I was like literally like being the geeky guy making all the sound effects noises and like, oh my God. I'm like, you're like, I'm leaving. I can't take being around you anymore.
It was, I'm sure, a mirror image. I got a chance to feel what it was like to be you.
I had that experience on more than one occasion, Cybersex shirt.
I'm a newbie. I'm not anti-anime. I'm anti-tentacle porn, but I haven't seen a lot of anime. I've seen some, and the stuff I've seen is a little bit more obscure because I ran in circles with anime people.
Those are very weird circles.
Yeah, well, I mean, I used to RPG and computer game, and, you know, there's a lot of crossover in that Venn diagram when you get into anime.
Yeah.
But because they'd already seen Cowboy Bebop and Ghost in a Shell and Akira, and they would just drop those references all the time.
Right.
I got exposed to things like The Giver. And, you know, we talked about some anime with Animatrix, and there was some Marvel cartoons that were anime that they dubbed into English that they did. They did an Iron Man and an X-Men anime. And so I've seen this kind of stuff. And I think the only big anime movie I've seen was, because now Plane covered it and I wanted to keep up, Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, Miyazaki, for me, that's like his own thing. But yeah, I guess that is anime.
Yeah, I mean, again, he gets equated a lot with Walt Disney, and I think for lots of different reasons. I mean, his movies are varied, but I do think they tend to be more fables for children. Some of them range really young. The thing that stuck with me always about Akira was the level of violence. I'd never got over how shocking all the blood coming off of the screen. I couldn't believe I had seen. I mean, I was a kid of the 70s. I had seen some dark cartoons. Watership Down, I don't know if you guys know that one.
Yes.
I watched that all throughout childhood, and that is bunny on bunny violence all day long. I could handle PG. I had never seen an R-rated cartoon before Akira.
And that's the reputation I knew this film had, because again, I knew about it before I ever saw it, but I knew it was supposed to be ultra violent. And it's crazy. I did finally get around to reading the comics too, which they started putting them out as trades. are like six, I call them phone books. They are very thick and go way beyond this movie. Like, it is shocking if you've read that comic and watched this movie. Like, yes, the violence is all there and they have this storyline, but it goes much deeper.
I think the comparison I made to you, Arnie, when I was trying to tell you about what you were about to step into, it would be like watching The Stand where the virus is spreading and then the next shot is everyone's in Vegas.
They cut out Akira in this, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say maybe 4/6 of the story is not here.
Well, what I came in expecting is you've been discussing this in relation to Dark Phoenix, and to a degree we were equating Dark Phoenix with Captain Marvel. So I honestly, knowing what I know about anime, and there's often superpowered females, I thought this entire thing was going to be about a superpowered female named Akira who was gonna be doing stuff. I couldn't have been more wrong if I were to guess what the plot was.
You weren't prepared for shriveled up psychic kids?
So shriveled up psychic kids, biker gangs, future Tokyo, none of it would have been in my purview.
Yeah, it is a shock when you get into it, because again, I saw that cell of the animation with the motorcycle, and yeah, when you finally watch this, it very different impression.
There's a lot of influence here, I guess we can talk about it, but for lots of reasons, I thought now was the time to talk about it. Yes, Dark Phoenix is the story of mutant kids rebelling and fighting military. It seemed like there was some crossover there. I do feel, as someone that didn't read X-Men comics, this was my X-Men. How people feel about Wolverine and some of those classic storylines from the 80s, that's how I felt watching Akira. I was very passionate and protective about that story, and I saw a story about youth rebellion in it. Katsuhiro Otomo is born in counterculture times. Now, he's in Japan, he's not in America, but he grew up watching American counterculture movies. So if you're getting the vibe of Easy Rider or Rebel Without a Cause or all this biker stuff trying to overthrow the government, yeah, that was what he was consuming. That was what he's loving. I think it's part of why this anime, more than maybe some of the other ones, connected overseas with Western audiences. Many of the influences in this movie are things that Western audiences are going to know about. They reference movies and directors and things that they've seen. I mean, 2001, Easy Rider, this is our culture. And Otomo, I think, borrows from it, liberally. Blade Runner, clearly an influence. But he was also inspired by anime and manga from his own culture. Tetsujin 28, I don't know this thing, but apparently it was a manga and cartoon series about a boy named Kaneda who had a robot with metal arms, and he said, I wanted to repurpose that story and tell it in my own way. He was approached in 1982 to write a serial manga about where Tokyo was heading, and he thought about the manga and anime that he loved, and he thought about all the American movies that he had seen, and this was a story that he wrote an outline for, but basically spent 8 years of his life drawing in serialized format, saying that it changed over time. Where he thought the story was going to be and what it ended up being became very, very different.
Yeah, I believe the movie came out before the series ended in comics.
Isn't that the most shocking thing?
That's kind of like Game of Thrones, I guess.
While he is drawing this years and years with no idea of how he's going to end it, he gets approached to turn it into a movie. You usually want to have something finished before you're like, yeah, let's adapt it. He completes this movie before he finishes writing and drawing the manga.
Same thing with Scott Pilgrim and, yeah, Game of Thrones. I don't find it that unusual.
Game of Thrones is unusual. Most people would not want to start a book series and then take it away from the creator to see somebody else finish it. That is bizarre. Here, what's different is that Otomo insisted that he would also do the movie as well as the manga at the same time. And so what he said was, with this film, he knew, obviously, with 2 hours, he was not going to be able to do what he had done over 8 years serialized in a magazine. So it's almost like he describes it as a spinoff. I'm going to take the characters and basic idea, but I'm going to give you something very different that will be digestible in a movie form, because I know I can't do what I did on the page, on the screen, in the time frame I'm given.
Usually when it comes to foreign films, I like to watch them in the original language and read the subtitles, except when it comes to anime. Like, I have this weird thing where I just usually end up watching the English version, even with Miyazaki. And yes, I've watched Ponyo and suffered through that voice acting work in English and Ponyo. But originally I saw this thinking my relative was doing the voice to find out there was another dub. And when I watched it this time, I watched that 2001 dub again. I could have watched that one or the original dub. I went with 2001. But do you know why they redubbed the film?
Nobody wanted to be unkind.
I've seen comparisons on YouTube.
People have tap danced around the idea that the original English language dub didn't get all the nuances right. I'm going to make the argument, for me, there isn't that much difference between them. Here's what I would say. The early English language dub is very, very much like you think of an anime. Those really excited voices, and they overperform and everything, and pronunciation. That would be the other thing. The Americans didn't get the Japanese names right. Case in point, the lead character in the original version is Kaneda, and I will always call him Kaneda because I heard it a million times as such and read it as such. But clearly, if you hear the Japanese version or the 2001 version, it's Kaneda. And yes, is it Akira or is it Akira? I mean, that's Western versus Eastern ways of pronouncing things.
And what about the subtitled version? Did you watch that? Is there a big difference with the original Japanese?
Every version that I watched, I watched with subtitles, and I was amazed at how what was being said was not what was being read. And I can only presume that's true of Japanese. I don't know much Japanese. I couldn't tell you what was being said. But the meanings of many of the scenes change depending on the choice of words. And so I would say that you could have entirely different readings about what's happening in the movie based on which ones you watch. Which one should you watch then? Well, if you're not a Psycho fan like me and want to see all of them, I would stick with the Japanese, partly because when some of the dialogue gets clunky, it always sounds nice in the native language,
yes.
Right? You know, like it can always just roll off of you when they're freeforming about evolution and amoebas and stuff that just doesn't work in the English language. You can hear the voice actor struggling to make that sound naturalistic. When it's in Japanese and you're just reading it, it comes off better. And I just think it makes more sense in the Japanese version. I actually found that the plot was more coherent and straightforward.
Well, I look forward to you clarifying. I watched the 2001 dub. I'm with you, Jacob. I always like watching the original language for live-action films, but I think that's because I want to see and hear the performance given by the people on screen. With anime, there's no actor embodying it. It's just people they chose to do the voice in the original language versus other people they chose to do the voice in my native language. And so I choose to watch the English one, especially since this is a more dense cartoon. I felt like I wanted every opportunity to understand it. Now, I guess my version wasn't as clear as the subtitles would have been, but I think I would have had a hard time keeping up with some of the data dumps subtitled.
And to be clear, you watched the movie without turning subtitles on in English.
Right, why would I?
Correct.
Because sometimes they'll say something and it's not what's written. It will be radically different things. I was shocked.
It sounds like they kept the subtitles for the Japanese dub and just carried them over to the English dub.
And no, actually, when you watch the Japanese version, the subtitles changed.
Those are different? Wow.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it was really surprising all the ways that different hands get involved and change the meaning. And so it's easy to be confused about what this movie is about, and watching all these different versions only increases that feeling.
And did this ever get a wide release? Or it sounds you went with your brother in his college town. Was this just a midnight movie, cult movie type thing? Or was it ever really carried in theaters?
Oh, it made $500,000 in theaters, Jacob.
Okay.
I mean, that's small potatoes. But for an animated film from another country and not made for children, I can't stress to you how unusual. They posted signs to make sure people walking in knew, although this is animated, this is R-rated, please know that your children are going to cry if they come in and see this film.
See, and I had seen around the time that you were seeing this, heavy metal and some of those other more adult.
Yeah, Fritz the Cat. You don't take kids to those films.
Yeah, I mean, those weren't widely watched. I mean, I get that you saw them, but those were bombs. And I don't think that those would have been in people's minds when they were taking their kids out. Animation meant children to 99% of the American population in 1990 or 91, whenever I saw this, and the theater went out of its way to stress that this was a different experience. And it felt very different to me. Like I said, as someone that didn't grow up watching animated movies, to see one this adult.
Yeah, to see bikers beat each other to bloody pulps.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I love the movie, but I really, again, I love the manga more. What was confusing was I was still collecting when I saw the movie. I'm like, wow, is that how it's going to end? I can't wait till I get clarity on the ending. And the American publisher for the manga kind of fell off. And I actually never collected the last six issues of the comic book. I never knew the ending as it was intended until just last week when I bought the box set and said, you know, I want to go back and read it all over again.
I don't remember all the details, but it is a fun read. Like, I was able to rip through it real quick. Very engaging.
It is seriously the most exciting comic book, maybe the most exciting book I've ever read. The way that he draws, the way that you can be looking at a giant close-up of the eye and flip the page and see hundreds of different, I mean, stylized as panels and a book, it's exciting. And I think this is a guy that I would have wanted to see a lot more work from. But it's strange. Otomo, he's kind of a one-trick pony. He made this, he made a few other things, but really this is what he's known for and this is what he's loved for. So, Arnie, I'd really love to know, what do you think the plot was of Akira?
Arnie's going to do the plot summary?
Oh, I'm sorry, Arnie.
I thought you were going to do this one because I have no clue.
Oh, but this is more fun. That's why it's entertaining.
All right, well, correct me when I'm wrong. I mean, I'm the newbie and I watched it 1.5 times.
All right.
The year is 2019, 31 years after World War III. We are in a rebuilt city called Neo Tokyo, built on the rubble of a Tokyo destroyed in 1988. Our story follows Tetsuya Shima, member of the biker gang The Capsules. During a skirmish with their rival clown gang, Tetsuo and his posse find themselves in the middle of a military operation, and he almost hits a small gray shriveled psychic kid. That child, Takashi, is telekinetic and uses his power to not be hit by Tetsuo's bike, but the bike crashes and Tetsuo is hurt. Tetsuo is taken by a secret military group run by a man called the Colonel. The Colonel's head of research, Dr. Onishi, discovers the accident has awakened psychic powers in Tetsuo. Tetsuo wakes up in the hospital and flees, but now that with the powers, he uses them to fight back against the military, and Tetsuo, as well as two other psychic children, Kyoko and Murasu. The power is making Tetsuo mentally unstable. He keeps psychically hearing the name Akira, and the doctor and colonel fear he may destroy all of Neo Tokyo. Tetsuo's best friend is capsule gang leader Kanata. Kanata has been trying to find and rescue Tetsuo from the government with the aid of resistance activist Ki. But when Tetsuo kills another capsule gang member, Kanata believes Tetsuo should be killed. Tetsuo goes to the Olympic Stadium in Neo Tokyo, where the colonel reveals Akira was a psychic like Tetsuo, and Akira destroyed Tokyo. Scientists studied Akira and dissected him, putting his parts in cryogenic storage. Then Tetsuo and Kanata engage in a duel. Kanata is armed with a laser that can actually hurt Tetsuo. But Tetsuo loses control of his powers and becomes a writhing, fleshy, tentacle mass that threatens to suffocate and crush everyone. The three psychic children combine their powers and break the canisters holding Akira's organs, and Akira reforms. Akira uses his power to take Tetsuo away, but Neo Tokyo is destroyed due to his power as credits roll.
Pretty good.
Did I get it right?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot about the ending that's vague. You had different ideas about what happened, but yeah, I think you did pretty well.
Yeah, the last half hour of this movie.
It gets weird.
I didn't drop enough acid to understand.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen 2001. Like, it goes there. There's babies, there's metaphysics, science.
I thought we were going to see a star baby up there.
Yeah, well, we saw some kind of baby, but I'll never forget. You know, in the way that people fear terrorism or school shootings now, we feared the bomb. And I've just never forgotten how impacting this opener is, where we just see, like, arteries, these populated roads stretching into the skyscrapers of Tokyo, and then all of a sudden, this beautiful dome, like, just rises off the horizon and eats everything in its sight. It's just such a powerful, not mushroom cloud, but just a new way of conceiving nuclear apocalypse.
And I thought it was just an A-bomb. Again, it's Tokyo. We already had Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I'm thinking about Godzilla and all of the monster movies that Japan created off of the fear of the radiation from the bombings that they'd had. So yes, in a story written in the 80s, I thought for sure this was a nuke.
Yeah, and I think they're still tapping into that. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like if, I mean, 9/11, it was tragic. 3,000 people died, and you see how Reeve reacted to that and how it scarred our psyche to have two atom bombs dropped on your country. I mean, yeah, I could still see them struggling with that and coming to grips with that, and you see that through a lot of Japanese cinema. They really trying to come to terms with that and explore those ideas. What I like about this opening is not just the way that dome expands and just a different way to show this explosion, but just their use of silence too. It's just totally quiet, and you usually think of an explosion, it's loud and big, but you just kind of see this thing growing. It's totally quiet.
Right. And not only that, but we jump, we get the title, it's over the giant crater that is left by this explosion. We don't really know why, who would have done it. It didn't even look like a bomb that was dropped. It just like suddenly appeared on the horizon. But we understand that out of this came World War III. And if you read the manga, you do understand a little bit more about that. But basically, the perception is somebody did this to Japan, but over the course of this story, we will find out that this is a homegrown issue, that this is because the Japanese were manipulating their children.
Yeah, when they say World War III, go, oh, okay, someone dropped a nuke on them. That's the assumption. Yeah, as the movie goes along, it's going to change that perception.
Yeah, I thought that Tokyo was the Archduke Ferdinand of World War III.
Yeah, it's a ruse. So you got that fairly early, or did that just kind of wash off of you, Arnie?
No, I got that fairly early. I just thought this was the first strike. I mean, it then jumps ahead and says after World War III, I figure we're seeing the first strike of World War III.
Right, but I guess my question is, when we're 31 years later into 2019, and I gotta say, it is kind of funny, next year, the Summer Olympics are being hosted by Tokyo, so there is, we're here, we're living it, but we never have a mention again about this war, or who might have caused it, or the Americans. Now, if you read the manga, Americans do eventually show up in there, and I think they're an important part of it, but here, it's almost just like, whatever, we had a world war, and now the point is, we're trying to rebuild, and we are now Neo-Tokyo. Would you describe it as a paradise, or a dystopia?
Oh, I definitely go with dystopia, because when we're introduced to it, it starts with a news report about masses of unemployed people because of tax reform and parliament and protests, and it's a lazy trope, but dystopias often take place at night. It's like there's no sunlight in a dystopia, and a lot of this takes place in darkness.
Yeah, I don't think anything here says that this is a great place to live. Like you said, Arnie, there's the riots going on because of taxes, very violent gangs all over the place. We're going to see what these schools are like at some point in the film. Like, doesn't seem like a great place.
You might be right. I mean, I definitely agree with you. And yet, one of my vivid memories of the movie was just being in love with how beautiful the city is when we go out on the bike ride. Like, it's like, wow, well, all those buildings that wiped away, boy, did they rebuild them. And man, is it magical to see this neon Tokyo.
Yeah, they totally tapped into Blade Runner. Like, that had to be a reference point for this film, because I was totally thinking that as they were showing the cityscape.
Was Tron also a reference? I was thinking that with these bikes. The way the motorcycle wheels were, the way they left streaks of light behind them. I was getting a little bit of Tron.
I feel like that's only Kanata's bike. Like, he has the coolest bike. And that's what shocked me, Arnie, is that you didn't know anything about this, because I feel like every Comic-Con, like, I always see this bike. It is so iconic.
Oh, it's on the cover of the DVD. I mean, I saw a person walking towards a bike, but I didn't know anything else about it, and I kind of thought maybe they'd form a mech. You know, that's a big thing in Japanese
sure.
Tales.
It was going to go Voltron.
Yeah, get one of each color and come together as something. Yeah.
Well, I was also thinking about, like, Spider-Man had his Leopoldin robot. I mean, I honestly thought, yes, the motorcycle would turn into a robot.
I've never heard him mention Tron as a reference, but he would have seen it, because that movie was, what, 81, 82? Mm-hmm. And that was when he started work on this, and this movie came out in 88 in Japan. So maybe there are lots of references. The one that sticks out to me, like, it's kind of downplayed here. This movie has lots of controversial elements, but I do think they kind of undersell the drug culture. this, when you read the manga, feels like we're watching the Droogs of Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yeah. You go to this bar and, like, it's just off in the corner, but, like, there's a guy, looks like sexually assaulting. I don't know if it's a male or a female, but they do not look like they're consenting. And Tetsuo's going to go back to this bar at one point because I guess there's drugs there. It wasn't very clear to me, but you do get that vibe.
Yes. This is a bar that you can, we see a man walk in, ask for some peanuts. I think he wants 3 peanuts. It's kind of like the Krover Milk Bar. Yeah, it's milk, but I don't think like it's just milk. I think there's things going on in there, and I think those peanuts are tablets that you would drop into your drink and then experience life in a different way. And this, the chemical pharmaceutical angle is very, very heavy in the manga. Everyone is on drugs. If you look at Kaneda at the jukebox, what's he got on his back but a big capsule pill? They're a drug gang. And drugs are, again, a big part. I guess depending on how you feel about drugs, this is either more of the dystopia or more of the utopia.
Yeah, I'd say that is definitely dystopia. Their rival gang, the Clowns, felt a little silly to me. It felt, honestly, Batman and Robin.
Oh, it just felt very Japanese to me.
Well, I mean, he's called Joker. I mean, yeah. That's, I mean, I don't know how you could not think of Batman. The leader is called Joker and is dressed as a clown.
Okay, I didn't realize the leader here was Joker.
But yeah, I mean, we want to see what are these gangs about, and they're about the ultraviolence and a little of the in and out.
Well, yeah, and a more serious reference for me would be something that he probably did read, though, maybe sometime in the middle of this, The Dark Knight Returns, where there were those street gangs of the Jokers and things like that.
Oh, yeah, that feels like he was influenced by this to me. I mean, I know Frank Miller was into manga. If you read Ronin, it's a total appeal to that style of comics. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some cross-pollination here.
I would also just say, taken out of the realm of comic books, I do know that Japanese biker gangs were a thing in the 80s. That was just something that wasn't just coming out of a book. That was a form of rebellion that they were seeing on the streets.
And one of the things we'll see as we get into this cool bike chase and fight, you'll get it later on, but I feel like I wanted more of it up front, is the relationship between Tetsuo and Kaneda. Tetsuo, it looks like he's about to steal Kaneda's bike, and there's some jealousy there, and we'll get flashbacks later on, but I feel like I wish a little bit of that was up front so I could understand the tension between the two as the story goes on.
I think it's the theme of the movie. I mean, I think this is a big, complicated movie, but if you want, like, the log line about what it's about kids trying to wield enormous power that they can't quite control, and we get it from this first scene here, where Tetsuo is, I think, maybe a year younger than Kaneda, and he has a bike of his own, but he wants to be the leader, and he wants to grab that power. He admires what his, I'll refer to as an older brother, has, and he wants it for himself. And so, yeah, he's there messing around on the bike, and Kaneda just says, "You're a kid. You can't handle this. Only a man can."
Yeah, you say older brother. I just feel like, where's the friendship in this relationship? It does feel like they're at odds straight from the beginning.
It depends on the cut. That is one thing I definitely okay. would say, that if you hear it in Japanese and hear it in the original English versus the later English, you can get entirely different perceptions about the tension between Kaneda and Tetsuo.
The weird thing is, you say Tetsuo is younger, but I have a real problem telling capsule gang members apart. This anime, a lot of the people bled together for me.
Tetsuo and Kaneda are the only ones that matter.
Yeah, the easy one is Kaneda's in red. I mean, like that, we can just get down to color. Kaneda's in red.
Weren't some of the other capsules also wearing the red coat?
No, none of them.
Ki has a red coat later on, but that's a girl, but she also has short hair.
No. He is wearing Kaneda's coat.
Oh, okay.
Well, the way I was able to tell Tetsuo is it looked like he had a receding hairline.
Yeah, he's got a big forehead.
He kind of reminded me of Walton Goggins a little bit. So you say he's 15. I thought he might have been 30 with that hairline. But that's how I was able to tell him apart, is he had very different hair. And then later on, he's maniacal and very easy to spot. But during these early scenes, he was the only one I could tell apart. I was getting Kaneda and the rest of the gang a little bit confused. And then they stumble upon, in the middle of their bike chase, I don't understand. There's a guy running with like a shriveled old little person.
a shriveled old little person. It's a child that has telekinetic and psychic abilities.
They are shriveled, though. I don't blame Arnie for thinking it might just be an old little person.
Oh, no, no. I think that's, again, part of the theme. It's a child trying to wield power it can't control. And if they're any good at it, it takes a toll on their skin and their face. All these kids were part of the Akira program that was started in 1979, about 9 years before Akira blew it all up.
So these kids are 40? Okay, I didn't get that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not going to get a lot.
In the movie, you're not going
to
get it.
Yeah, there's a lot in this movie that is not going to be articulated to you. And again, Otomo understood that and went with it. He was like, I'm more concerned about visuals, being able to work with taking what was on the page and moving it and seeing what I could do with camera effects and sound and creating a visual experience.
Yeah, and I think this opening bike chase, the violent is very R-rated, lots of blood. I do love the animation here. And you can say, oh, this is just like a house style anime. This is what it looks like. There's something very kinetic to this and very gritty. It just looks like a dirty film.
With the anime, that is my reference points, which I mentioned some television stuff. And my honest go-to is Voltron, you know, which was a Japanese anime that was dubbed into English and shown here. To me, this has a lot of that house style and a lot of the repeating backgrounds and things, but I am impressed with some of the shading and the details. It definitely felt cinematic. I often complain about that when we watch a feature film that's animated. Does it have feature film worthy animation? I think this one does. I mean, I wish the character designs were more distinct, but the vehicles, the city, the lights, the shadows, and simply the smoothness and the amount of motion, whereas in so many anime that I have seen, it's just a single image that's like being panned.
You're thinking of Speed Racer.
Yeah, yeah. Speed Racer. And here, everything keeps moving all the time.
Yeah, this is way on a better level. I bristle at someone that's going to call this house animation. No, Voltron is not this. This is well beyond that. They had more than $1 million on this movie, and it shows.
They had $9 million. It was the most expensive anime to date.
It was nine? I thought that was 9 million yen.
No, it was $9 million. It was like something like 1 billion yen or something.
Oh, wow. Yes, I just wanted to stress the fact that, yes, there are certain things about Japanese animation that you can find in all its variants, maybe facial expression or the stasis of movement and the way they play with that. It feels like a Western Hollywood movie in many times. I feel like visually, these are camera tricks we would see in an American film. It doesn't feel very Japanese at all.
I'm going to dispute that. At no point does this feel like Western-style animation to me. This always does feel anime.
No, not animation, but I think the way it's shot and the angles. Yeah, I agree with you, Stuart.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Western animation. I'm saying the way that the West makes movies is different than the Japanese, and this emulates more of the West than the Japanese.
Yeah, I watch a lot of Japanese cinema. I love Yakuza films and samurai films, and it's just got a different pace to it than you expect with even a martial arts film. They're just slower, and they want to sit there and ponder, and then there's a quick slash of the sword, and the fight's over. Like, this does feel very Western, very kinetic, very fast-paced, and just moving all the time.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things, you know, thinking about Blade Runner, obviously an influence when you look at this neon world, was Blade Runner was so worried on some level about the Japanese taking over America. Look at what's going on here. You see all this English language on the windows, on the neon, all of it is catering to some kind of Anglo audience when we see the bars and stuff. That was drawn that way. That wasn't something redrawn for the American release. This was a conception. I take this to mean that on some level, the Japanese were worried about America.
Well, yeah, if you're talking about a bomb being dropped on your country, you are worried about America, especially if you're Japan.
Yeah, and then they came in and destabilized you. That power struggle that thematically runs through all of this about the child that wants to rebel against authority. It's unfortunate that they weren't able to get some of the American characters and military that come into the manga, because I think that's important to what Akira is all about. But anyway, it is a great chase. It's super exciting. And what you're asking is being thrown in the middle with the psychic kid. There is a rebel group. We have that clearly established from news reports and all over the place. There are people that are angry about the financial situation they've been put in by the fascist military piecemeal government that is running things. And one of them has broken into the Kira program. One thing that gets short shrift, it's only a few lines of dialogue. And again, which version did you see? It may not be in the one you watched. But all of the tax money that was taken from people was put into the Kira program. And so this rebel broke in to find out where was all their tax dollars going and realized that this is a weapon. This child has abilities that can be weaponized and that the rebels could actually use it to fight the militias with guns.
But the kid was running of his own volition, right? He was trying to escape the program because later a different kid has to say, no, you need to come back.
Professor X? He's got the floating hover chair?
Yeah. Again, one of the things that gets short shrift is drugs. But all of these psychic kids are dependent on staying in the nursery at the Akira program because they're fed drugs. And if they're not fed drugs, they potentially could lose control of their abilities and have seizures, explode into giant babies, you name it. They could lose their control. And what happens in the manga is that Takashi just realizes he can't walk any further. That the spy getting him out gets gunned down and he tries to make it on his own. And he just simply can't go on without another hit of the capsules that they feed those kids.
And when we see Tetsuo driving towards him, my assumption is he used psychic powers to blow up his motorcycle. And that's what injures Tetsuo and kicks off his storyline.
You know, that's an interesting one. Yeah, they lead you to believe that this contact, because keep in mind, these kids aren't supposed to be known. They've never been out there. They haven't come into contact with other people. I guess it's considered that their powers may be contagious, that you could actually get some of what they got going on there. I don't know exactly how it works.
There's going to be a lot of talk about evolution and moving to the next stage throughout the film. I guess everyone has this power in them if they develop it.
That's certainly where this movie is comfortable leaving it, and I think that works well enough. But there is stuff about various translations of the manga in which they claim that Tetsuo's father was actually in the Akira program. You'll notice every mutant child has a number tattooed on their palm, and his dad would have been one of the first kids. Maybe he was 7 or 8 or something like that, and he didn't work out well. They've kept the kids that have been the most successful, and that's number 25, 26, 27, and of course, Akira, number 28 in cryogenic freeze. But this was essentially an attempt to overthrow the government by sneaking out one of the psychic kids that they have in top secret nursery.
And see, I thought they were kidnapping this kid. It looked like he was going along willingly, but you're saying to use as a weapon. I just thought to reveal whatever the government was up to, that they were experimenting on kids.
Well, I think that's why Key and Roy are involved. I mean, again, this comic book, there's so many more characters and subplots. Takes you a long time to realize that the rebels are not much better than the people that are suppressing them. And so you really are thinking, yeah, free the kids, get them off the drugs, make all of this happen. But in fact, it's hard to root for anyone. There's nobody pure in this Neo-Tokyo. Ki is as close to an altruistic character as we get, because I do think she wanted to just take this kid and nurture him and, yeah, maybe expose where the tax dollars are going. But she doesn't get a chance to get the kid because the colonel shows up and Tetsuo is taken away with Takashi.
And this is an exciting opening. I'm having a little trouble keeping track because it's rather random that a bike gang stumbles upon a military operation and one of the bike gang is pulled away. And we follow the rest of the gang. They're taken to a police station and interrogated. If you listen to the way I did the plot summary, I talk about Tetsuo a lot, and I feel Tetsuo is the main character, but yet the way the story starts out, we're going to focus a lot on Kanata.
Yeah, he's the star. He's on the poster biggest. He is the character that is in every issue. He doesn't have to be. Honestly, you could have told the story completely without a biker gang in the middle. I think because this manga was written specifically for Youth Magazine, it was a magazine geared for young men readers in Japan, that they realized they needed their target demographic as the star. And so Kaneda is given that role.
Yeah, and I like some of this world-building stuff you get because the biker gang is here. Like, they're all taken by the police, and they're just trying to find out. They're like puppets for the colonel. They're just trying to find out where this kid is, and as soon as they find out they don't know, they're like, okay, be gone with you. You had nothing to do with this. And we'll see him in school. Like, just an awful school. I would not want to go to that school with all these rebellious teens that just don't care for their teachers.
No, but I would want the rebellious kids to go there where somebody's punching them. Discipline! 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 I don't know if that's what they shout in the other languages, but that's what they shouted in mine.
Only in some. The early English dub, they did not. I think they called them stupid. But again, I think of Clockwork Orange. You saw the way the Droogs just did not conform with regular society. They were apart from it, and they didn't want to be a part of it. They were happy to live on the fringes and to cause violence, and sexual violence, too. I want to stress, if that's stuff that makes you uncomfortable about Japanese anime and manga, it is much darker in the comic book.
Yeah, but we do see, you see, Tetsuo's gonna escape this hospital he's in, where they're starting to see, oh, there's weird brain activity with him, but he escapes, he steals Kanata's bike and takes a girl with him. She gets sexually assaulted by the clown gang. Let's get revenge on him. Like, rip her shirt off and then punch her in the face. It is, again, very brutal, very R-rated.
Yeah, that scene is disturbing. I think I'd have a problem with it in any film. I have more of a problem with it in animation because, yeah, I think I just think of it more as a kiddie medium.
Yeah, it's not just rape. It's the physical violence, too. Punching her in the face and then all the blood. It just takes it to a different level than you normally see, except, I guess, in a Death Wish film.
Yeah, and here I am thinking, wow, they really lightened it up because, and the manga.
Yeah, if you're comparing it to the manga.
Yeah, here she's the girlfriend of Tetsuo. In the manga, she's his sex slave after he becomes power mad, and there's all kinds of orgies and really crazy stuff. Yeah, the fact that they all seem to have girlfriends, or at least a clique of girls that really admire them, feels like some kind of concession.
I guess the 21st century has really rubbed off on me because I got uncomfortable with some of the sexism because Kanata does get Key out of prison saying she's in our gang and then starts hitting on her. And the moment that, like, she won't respond, he's like, "You cold bitch!" I'm like, wow, that is some toxic masculinity there.
It is toxic, but these guys are in high school. Like, that also feels real to that.
Yeah, and again, droogs. These people go out, they do very bad things to men and women at night for fun. They are not heroes. They are anti-heroes. And so it is just because they're in a world with so much going wrong that they have the opportunity to get involved and help with the overthrow of this fascist regime. Although, again, I think you could look at the colonel with some sympathy, maybe not in this movie, but he is trying to hold it together. In his mind, he's doing everything that he can. He was alive when that experiment went off in 1988. He's one of the few people here who were, and he wants to make sure it doesn't happen again. He's done everything to make sure that the Akira program doesn't wind up blowing up Neo Tokyo.
It's hard to get a handle on the colonel because he is so over the top. I'm assuming he's like that in all the different dubs and translations. I mean, he's going to throw a coup later on in the film. And on one hand, I'm like, yeah, he's getting rid of those dirty politicians. Like, they are just the worst, stealing everyone's money for whatever. But he, at times, he seems almost noble, like he's trying to stop another nuclear explosion from going off, but he's also kind of a fascist.
That's what I like about him, is we start off, I mean, he's chasing down a child or old child or whatever, and we think that he's the bad guy. I mean, that's just how it goes in these stories, is rebellious youth, good military, bad. But we're going to find out he is noble. He is trying to do what he thinks is best to protect his nation, and he has conflicts about it. He is conflicted about how much he hurts people and what the trade-off is for protection.
And I do feel like that's a dialogue that Japan has with these kind of movies. If you see the original Godzilla, it's, oh, we could develop a weapon even stronger than the nuclear bomb to kill Godzilla, but should we use it? It almost feels like they're having this dialogue. Do we get revenge? Do we develop an even more powerful weapon to get back at the West? Or do we come to terms and move on and go another path? And I do feel like that is wrapped up in this colonel where, again, he's throwing a military coup at one point, but he also doesn't want this kind of disaster to happen.
Depending on what version you hear, again, I think that in the cleanest version, the way that I understand the movie framing it, it'll be different when you read the comic book because they can get into so much more, is the colonel feels like he needs to keep the numbers. That's what I call them. The psychic children that are alive, funded and in secret because they are our protection should the energy of Akira manifest again. Akira exploded, and we'll find out in this version, he was diced up into little body parts, but his ghost remains. His spirit remains. And in some ways, you can look at what's happening to Tetsuo as a possession, as Akira coming back through him.
Yeah, we'll see the other psychic children say that they feel like Akira is talking to him, and Tetsuo could hear that voice in his head.
Right. He represents a warning about too much power too soon. And that certainly seems to be what's happening with Tetsuo as well, as he, again, showing incredible psychic ability. But when the scientist guy maps it out, it sure looks an awful lot like that sphere of death that blew up Tokyo in 88.
This is interesting because I didn't expect Tetsuo to be the villain the way he's introduced. I mean, yes, he's part of a biker gang who's beating up on clowns, but so far I've not seen anybody who seems noble in this world, but he's abducted by the military, he has to run from them, he says he's on an operating table. He seems like the victim so far.
Yes, you can see him as someone that was made to be this way.
Yeah, he gets caught again and has this vision like where his guts are just falling out. It's very gruesome. But so you do sympathize with Tetsuo early on, and maybe throughout the film you do.
Yeah, there's so much power coursing through him, his body can barely contain it. I mean, that's the way that I'll read his physical transformation, is that the more powerful he becomes, the less you can keep it all inside, so to speak. Again, I think that those numbers they're trying to communicate with him, possibly trying to threaten him, maybe even trying to kill him. It's not really clear, but boy, do I love when they come to him in toy form and try to open that dialogue.
That is so bizarre. You see him throw this like teddy bear off his bed, and then it like climbs back on there. I mean, we've just been talking about those Toy Story movies. This is the horror version of that. And then they combine into like this giant teddy bear, which again, resembles a lot what Tetsuo is going to look like by the end of this film. Just all these pieces coming together. It is horrific, and I just love the animation of it.
Yeah, this scene was always one that I cherished from the earliest viewing in that movie theater. It never left me. That they're oozing milk, you know, like that just seems to make it worse. It just, it is. It's a horror movie moment. And yeah, you can feel for Tetsuo. This is a kid that just wanted to, you know, be tough in a bike gang fight and wound up now, yeah, dealing with stuff that Kaneda could never handle. And again, what do the kids want to do? Maybe they want to kill him. Maybe they just want to scare him. Maybe they want to scare the Akira out of him. It's not really clear in any version, I can't say, but it is an evocative image. This is where we start to learn about Kyoko. She was the bunny rabbit that appeared in the nursery. Masaru is the one that's always in the wheelchair. He was the toy car. And then the teddy bear was Takashi. And that's why, you know, they kind of look like the toys that they took on. But Kyoko is, not only does she have telekinetic powers, but she can actually see the future. And her predictions are rarely wrong. And she is now having the same visions that he is, that there is going to be another bomb blast. And that means seeing Akira again. And so the colonel is going to go down into the basement and just make sure, is he still down there? Like, have we done a check? And we get that great image of him descending into the cryogenics chamber.
I guess I didn't realize that's where he was going during that. But this movie does not spend too much time without action occurring. And during the same time, we've got insurgents trying to break into the compound.
Right. Everyone knows that Akira is the thing. And what isn't clear maybe in the movie, but much more clear in the manga, is those rebels thought that when they grabbed Takashi, they had grabbed Akira. They didn't really know what Akira was. They just knew that it was a psychic boy. And so this is probably him, right? I mean, how many kids look like this? And they were disappointed as anyone to find out that Akira is this mythical thing that no one has seen.
Well, that's my question for Arnie, because I know, Stuart, you know what Akira is, and I know what it is. But did you know, Arnie, at this point that it was going to be another kid? Or because they do keep that a mystery till the end, like what is in this cryogenic chamber?
Like I said, Stuart told me this tied into Dark Phoenix. I thought it was a superpowered woman that was going to come somewhere. At certain points, I thought Ki would realize she really was Akira and have the power.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's not crazy. I guess they could have done that. She will end up being the puppet of others. In this movie, the shorthand is Kyoko, the girl psychic child, will take over her body from time to time to help her along, yeah, as the rebels keep trying to break into the base. In the manga, gets much more complicated about how they try to use her.
Here's my question, because with all these different factions, the military, these rebels, there's also, like, these cults that we'll see that worship Akira and, like, want him to come back, and I wasn't, like, why do they want this to come back if they know that he was the cause of the destruction of Tokyo?
Yeah, this is probably my least favorite rewrite of the characters, but you'll notice in a few scenes, there's a crazy woman with like John Lennon sunglasses trying to preach.
I didn't realize that was a woman.
Yeah, she's preaching some kind of Akira church, and it's looking a little bit culty. It's a little bit Charles Manson-y. This is not how the character is in the comic book. She's very sensible. She is actually one of the children from the Akira program. I forget her number. I think she was number 20, but she managed to get away. And she has formed the church to try and help the rebels on the outside and is actually a very benevolent character and a very useful character that has a whole storyline. Here, she's a crazy woman holding a torch that falls off a bridge when it collapses. And that's too bad. I really liked Miyaka, but this is what you can do in 2 hours. And maybe they shouldn't have included her at all, but I think what we get from it is the sense of building chaos. That if Akira is coming or not, this city is about to tear itself apart. You can feel it in the streets.
Yeah, and I like that vibe. I've read the manga. I don't have a total full memory of it. It's been at least 6 years since I read it. But I do like the sense in this film. It doesn't always make sense, but the sense of chaos that's going, that this is a city about to erupt. I mean, literally or figuratively, I do like the environment and just the way they're showing it to us, even though it doesn't always make total sense. I feel like there's a lot missing, and that's because there's, about 4 books missing from it.
And I'm finding myself a little frustrated in the storytelling. I can't get a real sense of the city. I know that there's riots and talks about this government and the taxation, but it's never made clear to me that the money's going to the Akira program. And I feel that we're so focused on Tetsuo and Kanata that I'm not able to get a whole lot of sense of the bigger story. The colonel gets just enough scenes to let me know what his motivation is, but it's not like it's ever clearly spelled out. Stuart, you're doing a lot of explaining from the manga of where the shriveled number children are from and how Akira or Akira related to all of this. None of this is really clear in the 2001 English dub.
Yeah, here's what I would say. For people that have no interest in reading 6 volumes of Japanese comics and just want to appreciate what they're going to have as an experience for 2 hours, think of this as a disaster movie. Think of this as we saw the bomb go off at the beginning to kind of tell you how bad it could be. We see a city that's being rebuilt. And like all disaster movies, it's populated with all kinds of crazy characters, some you like, some you don't, and what's going to happen when it goes off. The anticipation is we know everything is building towards finding out about Akira, and by 40 minutes into the movie, you know that he's in a cryogenically frozen tank, whatever he is. You may, if you have a quick eye, you may notice that Tetsuo keeps actually seeing a little boy in visions. That is the Akira that will actually be a major character in the manga.
That's the crazy thing. It is, a full-on character that's like ruling Neo Tokyo in that book. Here, it's a vision.
Right, yeah. And I respect the fact that Otomo was detached enough from his source material that he felt like, I can go in a radically different direction in the movie than what I'm trying to do on the page, because there's no way that I can do what I've been doing for 8 years in 2 hours.
See, and my point of reference was not a disaster movie, but I was thinking about a number of stories where you see people granted powers. And I was thinking of a number of actually old Gene Roddenberry Star Trek episodes. And one of the lines that Spock said is, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. What I'm liking is that, when we reviewed Toy Story, I said, you got to have a reason to use animation as a medium. And when I see live action stories of people given this power, they're always isolated. They're always the threat if they get to the rest of society what will happen. Here, because this is anime, we can actually see a city torn apart and how powerful he really is. He's ripping up streets. I noticed some imagery here that recent films would rip off. I'd say The Matrix and Superman and some others with the floating rocks. Like when Tetsuo starts to really get his power up, the ground around him just starts to lift up. We saw that, hell, to go to Dark Phoenix, X3 The Last Stand had a lot of that.
If you saw that found footage movie Chronicle, I really felt like that movie wanted to be Akira really, really bad.
Yeah, I feel like Looper even turns into kind of an Akira movie by the end of it. It was weird.
Yep, Looper is a wannabe Akira for sure. Yeah, it's here's the thing. Like, it's influenced by a lot, but it has been around long enough to be influential as well. And because they've never made a live-action movie from it, I do feel like a lot of live-action movies feel they can steal from it. Because, hey, it's not real. It's this animated thing. If they did it in animation, we can be the ones to bring it to life.
But it's around this time Tetsuya, he escapes again, and he goes back to that bar, and I feel like you could have showed something really horrific. We're just going to see the aftermath, though. He's killed the bartender, and I guess I didn't realize they got drugs here, but he talks about how he needs pills to fight back the pain, and so I guess he went there and just destroyed it. I feel like this is the point where he really does start to go evil. It's not just, you know, how am I dealing with these powers? Now he's made a choice.
Yeah, they're stalling. I mean, in the comic book, all he cares about at this point is finding Akira and getting down to the basement. And here, because they need to kill Yamagata and give Kaneda some reason to want vengeance on Tetsuo, they kind of insert this in here. They kill the bartender who never dies. I don't know. There's a lot that long-term fans of the comic book are going to go, but I try to hold on. I put that aside and go, this is the movie, and just appreciate it for, again, the moment-by-moment thrills. Like, it is very creepy the way that his drug face is something else. Kids don't do drugs. It's a great just say no ad when he's popping the pills in the bar and sees his old friends and realizes, again, this is a kid that used to love and ride with this gang. We didn't see a lot of that, but he wanted to be one of them, and I guess he never felt like he could. And now, how perverse a thrill it would be to be more powerful than them, to be able to literally crush them with his mind. We see him scanner style do that to several people. Just they splatter against the wall.
And I wish we did see more of that. I wish that we saw why he would feel that way. The only way I could take this is shorthand that they were all friends and that this power was driving him mad. I mean, he's making strange facial expressions. He's hearing voices in his head. The little children are appearing to him in visions of teddy bears and little cars.
The way Key says it is like an amoeba trying to jump through the evolutionary stages and just become a human right away. That's what it's like. To all of a sudden have these powers. It's a huge jump in evolution, and we're just not ready for it.
Yeah, and again, the power dynamics are the same all over the place, that he wants to be the big shot in the gang in the same way that the Colonel wants to run Neo Tokyo, in the same way that Japan wants freedom from its American oppressors who have to come in at the climax of the comic book. It's the kind of thing you want to spend a lot of time on ruminating when you're making a major epic on this scale. And this thing, you get the sense of it. You can be impressed with how daunting it is, but you can't comprehend it here in the movie. I fully recognize that when you see certain characters like Nezu, this little guy, like, surprise, surprise, he's the mole in the council. Do you remember this scene?
Yes.
Yeah. He's the little ratty guy. Who would have thought the mole would be the guy with the rat teeth? But yeah, he's working with the resistance, feeding them information, trying to overthrow the colonel, all of that stuff. All I can say is it's something that you'd really love if you give it the time that the manga does. Here, it just sort of creates a sense of chaos. You can't understand it. It just feels like, wow. I don't feel like there's a scene that goes by without someone spitting up blood and dying. I mean, it feels like a movie where just so much bad is going on.
To a point where I'm feeling abused by the movie, where it's just pummeling me with violence after violence without giving me a chance to care about any of the characters except feeling a little bit of empathy for Tetsuo, the one committing the atrocities.
I feel like that, again, going to Stuart's argument that this is a disaster film, that's kind of how those are. I feel like those are ensemble films, and those work best when they're ensemble films, and you're just getting the vibe of the chaos going around and whatever the disaster is.
Yeah, the good thing about ensemble films is you have usually a group of very talented actors who bring a lot of character to their performances. And here, I'm just not getting it. And I'm going to blame the dub a lot. I'm going to blame the language and the fact that I also still have trouble telling some of the characters apart. I never understand the point of Key in the story.
Yeah, Key's not one of my favorite characters. I don't think that Otomo really writes interesting women. It would have been something if Akira had been Dark Phoenix. That would have been an interesting challenge for him. I do think he's much more interested. In his mind, rebellion and aggression is a masculine quality. And I think all of the great characters in Akira, with the exception of Lady Miyoka, that crazy woman that's in the streets, the men characters are the only ones that matter in the comic book.
But Key is along for the ride so often that I feel she should be important. So what I'm getting is a lot of violence and not a lot of characterizations that an ensemble would bring to me. And so I'm starting to really feel like this movie's a half an hour too long. There's like a half an hour of violence that it becomes almost nonsensical.
Okay, and where is that happening? I mean, are you having any kind of anticipation about meeting Akira?
It goes away. I had it for like the first 45 minutes. Where it really starts to tire me is at the 1 hour mark. And I'm like, wow, we have so much more to go on, but I don't see the characters getting any further. By this point, Kanata wants to kill Tetsuo. Tetsuo is maniacal. The three number children are trying to stop him. And we're just going to have a stalemate for like a half an hour of this.
I don't disagree. This is where they are doing things that the comic book didn't, to try and prolong it. Because they've made the decision that Akira rising up is their climax. There's like two climaxes, really. But because they're making that the climax instead of the beginning of Act Two, which is how the story really works, then yeah, I think that you're right. It just becomes a lot of psychic kids making floors crack open and throwing things around. I still love that, though. I want to distress, if none of this makes any sense at all, watch some of this movie, because I think it's just great fun if you like violent entertainment. It's just a great dark vision.
I appreciate the grittiness of this, and because it's animated, I don't know, that just brings something more to it. You don't see a lot of animated features. And again, I've said, I don't want just a house style with computer animation or whatever. Do your own thing. Come up with new ideas. And so, yeah, tell adult stories. It doesn't always have to be G or PG. So I'm going with a lot of the crazy imagery and just the sense of chaos throughout the film. I agree, Arnie. There are lags in this film. There are times when I don't really understand what's going on. But because I enjoy just the craft of the animation and just the general vibe of it, I probably give it more than you probably are.
Yeah, I do like the animation style, and I do like some of the violence and the originality of it. And what I had kind of thought was, I'm again the newbie to this, I watched it once, and I found myself wondering, if I watched this once a month ago, and then came back and rewatched it, what would I get out of it? Now what you're telling me, Stuart, is if I'd rewatched it in various languages, I might have gotten something, including other English, I might have gotten something else out of it. But you're also telling me that at no point is this ever going to be really coherent.
No.
And so if I get tired of watching anime characters just pummel each other, then and just kill and explode, it was novel at first, but I do feel abused by this film.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something I never feel. I love the thrill of chaos, of feeling things spinning out of control and building towards what Akira will be. And when he goes down there, like spaghetti western style, I love it. He gets, instead of a poncho, he gets that red cape.
Yes.
And he goes down there and is like, I'm just going to psychically pull this ball up into the Olympic arena.
I just watched Brightburn the weekend before we were recording this, and I couldn't help but think about how Brightburn did rip this off in certain ways, from the red Superman cape to the person discovering powers and turning evil and starting to terrorize people.
Superman did have a red cape, but I do feel it's subversive putting it onto an all-powerful character like Superman, but that's evil.
And not only that, but to me, in following the color pattern of this movie, this is Tetsuo saying, I'm Kaneda. Kaneda was the guy in red. I can be the guy in red. I'm more powerful than him. And I kind of love that Kaneda can go toe-to-toe with him, even now that he's this psychic monster that can fly.
I mean, he does have a laser.
Yeah, he packs that laser cannon, and I love the way that he's confidently... Like, if Arnie started flying around right now, I wouldn't feel like I could get a weapon to beat the Masked Marauder.
I did wonder how the laser could affect him when nothing else could. He's stopping bullets. He's shaping lasers around him with his telekinesis. Because the military pulled out laser guns, and he was able to just Neo-like put his hand out, and I realized Neo ripped this off.
I think they have different settings. I think there's stun settings, there are kill settings. And I love that Kaneda finally gets the kill shot right in the torso, and it runs out of battery, so it doesn't harm him.
But the colonel has an ace in the hole because Star Wars, the satellite program, was just getting started. Always love this detail. They just decide, why don't we get one of those lasers in space and just zap him? Just blow his arm off. All these fights are in the manga. And again, they're just as exciting on the page. It's different experiencing them as cinema. And I like it, particularly because it's color. The manga is black and white. So the color adds something different.
Yeah, every once in a while, they do a couple pages in color. Like, those are the front pages in whatever magazine it was being serialized in. So they got to be in color. But most of it is black and white.
But that is definitely part of the thrill of, as someone that was reading the story unfold, to go to the movie to see all of this come in this bright, attractive color. It's something. And again, the way that Tetsuo Badass just says, all right, I'm going to go fly. I'm going to just fly into outer space.
I think it's because he's pissed off. We see that he's not invincible. He loses his arm here.
Yeah, he is losing. But again, my chips are still on him because he can fly into space and break up the satellite and it comes streaking to the ground.
I love that sequence. It's so good.
It's amazing. And yeah, he'll just reform his arm out of metal and we can see what is Akira finally. The stunner, particularly if you read the comic.
Yes.
It probably is for everyone, but particularly if you know where it was going to go on the page for several volumes of story, is that the character is dead. That Akira did not survive losing that power. And in some ways, that kind of makes sense. The fact that he blew up Tokyo, why would he survive that? Why wouldn't he be in debris?
I had come to that conclusion by the time we get here, was that Akira had been the guy who blew up original Tokyo, and why would they let him live? I assumed he was dead. I was surprised, not fully, but I was somewhat surprised when he did reform. But the fact that he was dead here, and they were just talking about the power of Akira, I didn't take it as outside the realm of possibility that that would be all Akira is a bunch of organs in a jar by this point. But I'm getting back into it here. Once Tetsuo loses his arm and starts becoming this robot arm and losing control of his own powers and everything,
my assumption is we'll see this arm start expanding and his parts are there, they're on ice, but I feel like his spirit or whatever, his psychic energy has possessed Tetsuo at this point, and that's why, yeah, that arm starts merging into other things.
That seems to be the interpretation of this movie alone. It's not something I had ever considered. It's something I completely forgot. I mean, they pair up and form a kingdom and become their own government, and there's 20 issues in between here and the second climax, where he's going to try to sit on a throne in the Olympic Stadium. I mean, could they make a better opening ceremony? I mean, this would blow the one from China out of the water if someone could actually do this. You know, get Mariah Carey on a wire, come in and do the singing, and then, yeah, you just, like, let the organs fly.
I'm confused. Did the Olympics, was that stadium there for Olympics that were coming?
Yeah, 2020.
Okay.
Yes, they were the next year. It says 147 days till the Olympics at the beginning.
Yeah, but I wasn't sure if they meant like the Olympics were coming in 1988 and then the city blew up. Because there are a lot of parts of the city that are still ruins that they go into that were not rebuilt.
Did you watch the Winter Olympics in Russia? That is how it was. Like stray dogs running around and they try to make hotels look nice and put on a good performance.
Yeah, so I wasn't sure if this was a new stadium.
This is their comeback.
Okay.
This is them saying, we're as good as we used to be, and if we can pull it together, we're going to have an awesome Olympics next year. But of course, it's also a front. It's what they're saying all the money is going to, when in fact, all the money is going below it to the Akira program. But yes, what is happening here is open to multiple interpretations. I won't begin to have any kind of authoritative stance on what we're seeing happening to Tetsuo, other than, yes, he's struggling with power, and that this is a literalization of having too much power. His face doesn't get shriveled. I guess he can feel good about that. Like, unlike some of these kids, he doesn't look like he has progeria, but he definitely is not looking good when the girlfriend is trying to help him and he just decides to spout arms that have arms for fingers that just, I mean, it's amazing. This is, again, the other thing you will remember about Akira. If you remember nothing else about the movie or what it made sense, you'll always remember the way that Tetsuo just explodes at the end of this film.
Yeah, I don't know if I understand this ending at all, but I do love the animation of him expanding and, yeah, his girlfriend getting sucked in. Kanata's gonna get sucked in, and the psychic kids, I think, get sucked in, or they willingly go in. But you're seeing this, it's almost like cancer, just seeing these cells grow and multiply out of control.
Yeah, it is a mutation. And it's manifesting in, I don't know what it looked like when Akira lost control. One thing that I kind of cite all versions of Akira as a fault was I always wanted to see the moment in close-up of what happened in 1988. What made him go off? Did it look like this? What would that be? I don't ever remember seeing anything like that in either the comic or certainly in this movie.
The fleshy mass, to me, looked a lot like just anime in general. This is where I usually see anime go, is to this kind of body transformation into some kind of Mudo at the end. But what I didn't expect, and perhaps my favorite kill of the movie, is when he absorbs his girlfriend and then crushes her like a soda can and she pops.
Yeah, that's amazing. That really was. And again, all he really wanted was a hug, and like, it just squeezed in a little too much.
And we get this line that this is the birth of the universe, one character will say. And yeah, is this the Star Child? Are they creating a parallel universe, these psychic kids? And this is just the energy. It is so bizarre where they're trying to wrap this up and go. It does feel like a very strange version of 2001, which is already strange.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I don't want to overread this. I'm just happy to go with the hallucination of it all. You're right. It is like just what you want to see in a Japanese adult animation. Just tentacles galore. Give it to me. I want to see it all. But I do feel like there's a real strain to go forward and back. Tokyo is trying to advance and become the Olympics and be a new modern society. At the same time, it's regressing and falling apart. This Tetsuo is getting bigger and having more power, and yet he's also becoming a baby, and he's losing his bodily organs and becoming, yeah, basically like a little one-cell amoeba. So again, that's the tension of this whole movie experience, is the push and pull between progress and regress. And Kaneda gets caught up in it, firing his laser.
Yeah, he was absorbed with the gun. I'm like, pull the trigger. Pull the trigger lots. But at this point, he and Tetsuo are starting to like reconcile. He's realizing Tetsuo is kind of screwed and can't control anything. He's feeling bad for his friend. He's no longer trying to avenge his fallen gang member. He's trying to, I suppose, help his friend, but also survive and shoot that laser and get the hell out of the tentacle mass.
Well, they get to some kind of Jungian idea that memories, like, that there's a collective unconscious and that things that happen to us get carried like, you know, cells or something like that into the new generations. It's kind of a new agey idea I'm not always on board with, but it's interesting. We see their memories. We see the first time that they met as children, and he's remembering the good time that, you know, they were both beaten up by bullies, but Kaneda got him his action figure back. There seemed to be some of that compassion you wanted established between the characters. It's what Tetsuo chooses to remember as he is regressing back to his earliest self.
Or expanding to something new. I am Tetsuo, as the film ends. He has become something else.
The way I would look at it is he moves beyond his body to become whatever Akira is. And so they're both ghosts, if you like that word. They're both things that don't have a body anymore. And will they manifest themselves in the city again? What would that look like? Is there a sequel brewing? Well, Otomo has never made one. I don't know what that would look like. But the implication, as I read it, is that he's left a mark a stain, perhaps, on the city. And he's given Kaneda an opportunity to live, to return to his friends, to date Key, who's now suddenly into him. She's wearing his jacket.
But she's psychic now, right?
She was the tool, the puppet of Kyoko. I don't think... Well, you know, the manga is different. I don't get the reading in this movie that she was anything other than possessed. But yes, the character is in the larger story.
Yeah, I thought it was left with a tease that she is now growing her own psychic powers.
To me, the tease is that we still have the potential to blow ourselves up or to advance into some new age where we're all psychic and doing incredible things.
I think that is, again, that dialogue that Japan has because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is, look at all this great stuff technology could do. And that's a stereotype of Japan. They got all this futuristic stuff, but it also like blew up two of their cities. And there is that conflict, that technology, it's amoral. It depends on the user, whether it's used for good or bad.
Yeah, and most interesting of all, this is a Japanese person acknowledging that Japan itself is responsible for it. You know, they have their own perceptions about being bombed by America and don't always take responsibility for their participation in what they did with Pearl Harbor and World War II. But here, the implication is we can do it to ourselves. And I think that's a very powerful thing to meditate on as this movie drifts to some kind of end.
Well, let's get to our own ending. Jacob Stewart, do you recommend, and how do you pronounce, Akira?
I'm going with Akira.
Jacob.
Yeah, if you ask me, it's just Akira. The 2001 dub, I don't know. There seems like there's variations in the way the characters say it. But Akira, I think, is how they normally say it. But I'll always say Akira, because that's how I said it in my head when I read the comic and when I just saw the poster and all that. But yeah, this is a messy film. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense at times. But I go back to, we talked about Blade Runner. And I know when we did that Philip K. Dick retrospective, like, I'm like, I struggled with that film. But when I went back and rewatched it before the sequel came out a few years ago, I just really got into the vibe of that film. It didn't change. Like, it's still like a messy story and very slow and doesn't, you know, just not the way standard story is told, but I could appreciate just that aesthetic and that vibe. And that's how I approach Akira, is it is a messy story. It's not always going to make sense. And because it's a foreign film, I always put a little bit of blame on myself because it is a work in translation. That's not a perfect thing. And so maybe if I learned how to speak or at least understand Japanese, I could fully appreciate it. But because it's a foreign film and in a different language, yeah, there are going to be those bumps in the road. But I love the grittiness of it. I love the violence in it. I love the animation style. And I just love all the stuff it's getting at. This feels like a 2-hour commercial. If you really like this, then go read the comics where you get the fully expanded universe and things will make more sense. But as just a sci-fi anime, I really dig this thing. And yeah, I could give this a solid recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, I mean, I have a hard time separating the experience. Frankly, Akira is the manga, is the visuals of the movie. It's the experience that really was defining for me. In 1990, 1991, Akira was everything to me. It's so much about what I admire in art, like it touched on, whether we're talking about dystopian sci-fi, body horror, living with the fear of nuclear annihilation, being a little kid and having conflict with your older brother or your idol. I mean, and yeah, ultimately feeling confounded by the universe, the way that the swirl of a DNA strand can look like the limitless power of the cosmos, and the feeling of how you can take it all in. Akira tries to be everything, and maybe it's too much for some people. I get that. It's a work that is not easy to condense, and in a 2-hour format, it feels very truncated from the experience on the page. But I love it. I went back and I read that comic book last week, and it reminded me of how exciting that medium can be. And coming back to this movie, I feel the same way about anime. A lot of times, anime can feel stilted or dull or silly translations, but this one just moves. It grabs me. It is the violence. It is the fury of it. It is the fact that it does pummel you that it overwhelms me. I love it. And I think it's a great way for Americans curious about that art form to get started. I mean, it was where I started. And Otomo's sensibilities are Western. Again, if you like Star Wars, spaghetti Westerns, biker movies, Kubrick, all of that is here for you to digest. And so, yeah, while I personally might have wished that he tried for a little more narrative closure, you know, ambiguity could be a little frustrating, certainly for me at the time, but I think you get it. Ultimately, if you look at the movie thematically as a struggle about coming into your power and how scary that could be, how cataclysmic that can be, I think you can get this movie and just ride it as a great entertainment, as a great piece of art, and really, really exciting animation.
Oh, yeah. I definitely say when the thing's over, I get it. I just don't know if I wanted it. I am of two minds on this. On the one hand, I think technically it is very well done, specifically for its time.
Yeah, there's no CGI enhancements in this.
I'm not sure that audiences who are going to walk out of Toy Story 4, yeah, will they be able to then sit down and appreciate this work that went into Akira? Because growing up with cel animation, I know how much work they had to have put into this. This was not computer generated. They had to do tons and tons and tons of frames, I'm guessing.
There was one computer that he was very excited about CGI's possibilities. If you noticed, there was like one shot of like the doctor measuring the aura, and it was like a little spiky crown.
That was CGI?
That was a CGI shot. But you're right. For the most part, this is old cel animation.
And it looks good. And it looks better than any other that I have seen, which I'm not deep into anime, but again, it's just the best I've seen it look. And I like anime style. So when I say that, I mean it as a compliment. There's something about just the big eyes, the round mouths, the flashy colors that I do like about anime. And the violence was shocking. And I mean that in a good way. I really had fun with a lot of the violence. I was disappointed when it seemed to pull its punch and not show us the death of the bartender. But I came in here expecting to hear that with repetition, I might get more out of this. And what I'm hearing is, no, this really just is not going to make narrative sense. And I feel the pacing of it is just off. And maybe it's because it's not a Western pacing. It may have Western story ideas, but it does not follow the pacing that I am used to with American cinema. And it feels too long and too incoherent. So to end on a positive note, what I'll say is that, Stuart, you've excited me about the manga, and maybe someday when I'm done with Stephen King, I will check it out. I really wish I had the time to check it out today. You've really sold me that I should look at those books. But for the movie, I gotta say it's a not recommend.
What? That's crazy.
Calm down, Tetsuo. Don't use those psychic powers.
If what I hear is correct, what you don't like, and I think it'll be a problem for you with a lot of Japanese work, is the fact that there's double speak and a reticence to come to a cohesive conclusion.
More, it seems meandering. There are 30 minutes of this film that I feel is just wandering about aimlessly.
Okay, but that's 90 minutes of good.
It's a weak not recommend. I wanted to love it, too.
All right, so you didn't like the movie. What about the video game? I'll tell you what, I didn't like that one.
I didn't know there was one.
It only came out in Japan for the NES. There were two games, it should be said. Right after the release of the movie in 88, they put out, I don't know what you would call this. It's sort of a terrible forced choice adventure game in which you can watch the movie again in pixel form. And then basically every now and then you can click on a character and ask him a question. Do you want to listen to them? Do you want to look at their desk?
They do make games like that today. I think Telltale games, they got Batman and The Walking Dead where it's choose your own adventure, basically.
Yeah, except whatever you choose, you wind up following the movie. Like, there's very little that varies from the movie you just watched, other than the fact that it's kind of charmingly bad pixels that are recreating the scene. So it was kind of fun to see Tetsuo giant baby, in NES form, but what a terrible game. And then the other thing they released at the time it for the 2001 DVD Blu-ray was a pinball game, because, like, who wouldn't want to play pinball? Like,
is like the ball the laser and got to shoot it into Tetsuo?
No, there's like his face is on the poster on a pinball machine of Akira. Fun, huh? Yeah, they screwed that up. But there was, I have to say, I've seen a little bit. It floats around on the internet. There was an attempt to put out a Sega Genesis. And it does follow all the scenes from the movie. You do fight clowns on bikes. You ride around on the floating platform. You have a first-person moment where you're Tetsuo going around psychically making nurses explode. Like, it looked kind of cool.
Was this a real game that came out?
It was coming out at the end of the Sega Genesis life, and I think they just realized there wasn't a lot of money for it in America, specifically, in 1994, 95, so it was never completed. As far as I understand, it lives on somebody's hard drive somewhere, never to be played.
These sometimes leak out. There is some old Nintendo game that people finished on their own and leaked it out. Hopefully that happens, because that sounds fun.
I mean, I feel like if there is a remake, we'll be getting that game, finally. They did try very, very hard for many, many years to find a way to bring this very, again, what feels rooted in the history of Japan, Hiroshima, nuclear apocalypse, and find a corollary here in America with a Hollywood remake.
Yeah, last I heard, it was Keanu Reeves and it was going to be 9/11.
Wow, that was a long time ago. I heard Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart?
Yeah, she was going to be Key, and the dude from Tron Legacy was going to be Kaneda. And I forget, there were several directors mentioned. It was Leonardo DiCaprio producing, Apian Way had it, and they were going to make the destruction and all of that at the Twin Towers. They were actually going to link it to 9/11 and not World War II or some kind of 88 bomb.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of uproar about taking this Japanese story and translating it to white people in America.
Look what they did to the Ghost in the Shell remake. I mean, people didn't even want to look at that movie because it was Scarlett Johansson. I definitely think we've reached a moment where people are saying they don't want to see white Hollywood co-opt native and foreign films. So what does that leave us with? What that leaves us with is Thor Ragnarok director Taika Waititi announcing that he's going to try and do it.
Oh, so it won't be whitewashed. It'll be Kiwi.
What he said was there won't be an entire cast of Japanese unknown, but that he's going to, it sounds like they're going to have a multi-ethnic class. They're going to try to not have it be specific to any one particular region or culture.
And has this gone into production? I know he's got coming out with a independent film this year, Jojo Rabbit, that I'm looking forward to, with ScarJo in it. But is this gone into production? Is this going to happen? Or is this just rumors?
I don't know. Again, yes, they're confidently announcing that it's coming in summer 2021.
Oh, they're even giving a date.
Oh, yeah. It's this time in 2 years, we will have it, supposedly. I'm very cynical. I've heard it and seen it so many times. Maybe.
And I would love to see a live-action version of this. I would like to see what they do where they take the basic story ideas, and with modern technology, you can easily make this live-action. And I imagine that they would tighten up some of the script a bit and lock down some of the details and maybe deviate from the source material.
I don't know. Is there a lot of humor in that manga? I don't remember it that well, but giving it to Taika, it does feel like it could become a comedy.
Well, I mean, there's even in this anime, I felt like the comedy, the levity came from the way that Kaneda was a skirt chaser that was, you know, always trying to get girls and such. I mean, there was a lot of pranksterism between the gang members, but humor, I mean, I experience it more, the vision of apocalypse and horror is a stronger way of reading the movie. But I suppose you could make it, I mean, a guy's arm falling off and turning into a metal arm was done as humor. They made a movie called Tetsuo Iron Man that was about that very thing. I guess you could play it for laughs.
But I'm interested in seeing this. This has piqued my interest in exploring Akira further.
Well, I'll say this. If the choice were between what's on the page and what's on the screen, go with what's on the page. I am a fan, first and foremost. Again, it's my favorite comic book. It's not my favorite movie. But it is a movie that was very important to me then and now. I mean, you always worry going back to a movie you haven't seen in a long time that was so formative. Like, am I still going to like it? And the truth is, I still think it's really exciting. Like, whatever it doesn't do in terms of story, I don't know how you can walk away and being like, I was bored. Yeah, maybe there was a few meandering places, but by and large, boredom is not something I experienced from that.
Yeah, all my complaints, boredom is not one of them.
No, quite the opposite. So much happens that I became numb.
You're overstimulated by it.
Yes.
Okay, maybe I like that feeling. That's what I respond to about it.
But patrons, thank you for joining us, and maybe in 2021 we'll have another patron episode as we discuss the live-action version of this. It would be our first patron follow-up. We've always made patrons one-offs. But thank you for your support.
And next month, one of you has donated so that we talk about the 20th anniversary of Eyes Wide Shut. I can remember very distinctly going to the movie theater with Arnie and the sounds you made when it was over.
Ooh.
Yes, I haven't looked back. I've kept my eyes shut to it ever since. I'm interested to revisit it 20 years later with totally different expectations.
Yeah, you're a married man now. It's a different place in your life. Maybe you can appreciate some of the things they were going for. I will say this. They marketed that movie as one thing, and it became something else.
It is not a sex film.
It is definitely not the horny, kinky, crazy movie that they advertised. But what it is, I'm curious to talk about, and certainly the story of how it got made is probably even better than the finish, though.
I can't wait to talk about Kubrick abusing Tom Cruise.
Yeah. But if you want horny and sexy, another patron pick the next month in August, we're doing Boogie Nights.
Sure, why not? Keep the good vibes going. In a way, because it feels like this new Tarantino movie. Tarantino was on the record saying Boogie Nights is one of his favorite films. I feel like this is his homage to that era of Hollywood and an ensemble cast. Seemed like a good time to come back and see the Paul Thomas Anderson movie about Southern California in the porn years of the 1970s. And in the Fridays leading up to Eyes Wide Shut, we're going to do catch up with a bunch of old series that you guys probably know, including Men in Black, Child's Play, and the Frost Peg series. They finally released in America Slaughterhouse Rules, so we're going to do that pickup.
Will it rule?
I don't know. I barely know. It barely got released.
And it looks like Peg and Frost are barely in it.
Wow, that would be severely disappointing.
They're listed at the end of the credits, like the with and the and. They're not the stars.
Hmm.
Oh, no. And it took forever to come out here, so.
Yeah, maybe it's better than Paul, at least.
That is not a high bar.
No.
So, Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. And until next time, just remember, amoebas don't make motorcycles and atomic bombs.
Is this Akira?
Yes. We called him here to the three of us. He's going to take Tetsuo with him.
Take him where? Where?
It's too much for Tetsuo. And for the three of us also. And for Akira, too.
It's way too big for us, as we are now.
But someday, we ought to be able to...
Because it has already begun.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
The future doesn't necessarily proceed along a single course. There ought to be a future we can choose. It's up to us to find it.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
Now what is at stake here is freedom of the press!
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Can I leave this in your hands?
Well then, in my opinion, if we can use the latest examination equipment to collect even more data, and also do a multifaceted analysis as we go...
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini-reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Well, they're more like some crazy cult than onlookers. They're following after the subject, and more keep coming!
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
You always show up and start bossing me around, and don't you deny it!
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
And now you're a boss, too.
Now Playing is edited by Arnie.
What's the matter? Is your head hurting? If you push yourself, you might do irreparable damage.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
You called me, didn't you? And I heard you.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I know it's hard for you to believe what I'm saying, but it's the truth!
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
You don't like what you're hearing, do ya? Makes you angry? So what are you gonna do now? Well?
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I'm not a scientist. I think like a soldier.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2019. All rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Look at what they abandoned in their panic. They were afraid. They were too scared, so they hid it away from the public, losing all sense of shame and honor, casting aside the civilization, and abandoning the science that created it, shutting the lid of the Pandora's box they themselves had opened.
You guys are going to kill me, but I was thinking of Real Genius, because that was the plot of Real Genius, was the satellite that could kill a single person.
Yeah, Tetsuo pulls out some popcorn, some Jiffy Pop, and heats it up with the laser.
And again, I think it's part of it is I'm not into anime by and large. I've seen some.
You saw Guyver. Guyver is the only thing I heard.
I haven't even heard of that one.
And I think because they made a live action with Mark Hamill in it. And J.J. Walker. That might have been why you ended him.
When was this? J.J. Walker?
Yeah, it was again, really good.
I didn't pick it. Somebody brought the Guyver season 1 and 2 to my house and said, we're watching this. So whether or not they were inspired by a Mark Hamill movie, I'll never know.
Southern California in the porn years of the 1970s.
Literally where I live.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The last time I tried watching this with my wife, we stopped about 10 minutes in because we're just looking up all the locations because they're all around us.
You got to invite me over some more. That's interesting.
Oh, I have seen porn films getting filmed on the sides of the roads here.
I know where my next vacation is. With some of the sexism, because Kanata does get Kia. Kia?
Key.
Key.
I'm going to call her a car.
Kia is the car you bought, right? The Iron Man car?
No, I bought a Hyundai.
Oh, the Hyundai. That's right. I feel like that, again, going to Stuart's argument that this is a disaster film, that's kind of how those are. I feel like those are ensemble films, and I'm sure The Rock is a hero in Skyscraper. I haven't seen it. I don't want to. But I feel like better disaster films, you just get a lot of different points of views. And
yeah, that's not a disaster film. That's a Die Hard.
Oh, okay. I thought it was about an earthquake knocking a skyscraper down.
No, it's about a bunch of people taking control of the skyscraper and trying to rob it.
Oh, okay. So it is a Die Hard.
I think you're confusing it with San Andreas.
Yeah, you're saying San Andreas.
Yeah, okay, San Andreas. There you go. There's another one. I knew he's done a disaster film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so what does that leave us with? Apparently, Thor Ragnarok director Taika... What is his name?
Taika Waititi.
Yeah. I want to always say Waititi. Thor Ragnarok director Taika Waititi.
And has this gone into production? I know he's got coming out with a independent film this year, Jojo Rabbit, that I'm looking forward to, with ScarJo in it, but...
ScarJojo Rabbit?
Yeah.